that's kind of for a project.
Oh, we're not ready
doing it. Who's going to come and turn that on? Or, you know, last time we said wind, turn on the light, because I don't want it.
That's a bright light, isn't it? You don't have to use it if you don't want light. Oh, okay. It's heard about it shining. It's not. Oh, test.
Is it on?
It's on.
Good evening. Welcome to another session of the Dallas Philosophers Forum. Hello. Welcome to another session of the Dallas Philosophers Forum. It's my pleasure here to start off the meeting and introduce our speaker. Before that, I'd like to just say a few things. We do meet every second and fourth Tuesday of the month, September through May. We also have a six-month membership for $35, and it's $5 a night if you choose to just come a night at a time. Glad to have you here. Please remember to pay your check at the end. Without further ado, I will start by introducing, I'm concerned I'm going to stumble on her name, but we're very glad to have our speaker, Pravajika Ramaprana, who is a nun of the Vedanta Society of Southern California at the Sarada Convent since 1973. She's been a Vedanta representative on several interfaith councils, including the Hindu-Catholic Dialogue sponsored by the Archdiocese of Los Angeles. She's a frequent guest lecturer at schools, colleges, and universities in America. She's participated in interfaith and scholastic seminars in America and abroad. Ramaprana has compiled and edited several books on Vedanta. Thank you. She has also written numerous articles on the philosophy and practice of Vedanta for journals and anthologies in America and abroad. Ramaprana resides in Southern California and is currently the resident minister of the Ramakrishna Vedanta Society of North Texas. Please join me in welcoming our guest speaker.
Can you hear me?
Is there any
way? Not yet.
You might need, yeah, we'll get it.
Well, it's coming through.
Yeah, get it.
Is this Michael?
Turn it off.
It should be on.
It doesn't feel like it's amplifying.
Oh. Now it is.
Now it is.
There you go.
We gotcha. All right. Oh. Actually, and some of these words are going to be a little tricky, but I will do my best to. How many of you are familiar with the Eastern traditions? Hinduism a little tricky. It's a little baffling and mind-boggling. I'll try to unboggle. My subject tonight is Who Am I? India's Experiments with Consciousness. My name is Pravajika Ramaprana. Pravajika means, it's a Sanskrit name. Pravajika means wandering mendicant. And Ramaprana, prana means life, force, breath, one whose life is in Brahman. And Brahman is God the Absolute, existence, knowledge, and bliss. I'm going to start from the beginning. The evolution of Indian spirituality. There are references in the Rig Veda, and the Vedas are the oldest living scriptures of the world. They were there before the written tradition. They go long back and memorized in the Brahmin caste literally every syllable backwards and forwards, so no syllable was lost. There are references in the Rig Veda to Aryavata, the land of the Aryans. And today this is the Indus Saraswati River Valley, which may also include Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan. It was a land so fertile that it only took these peoples 90 to 120 days to till their crop of cereal on which they could live for a full year without having to work. So the rest of that time, they observed the natural phenomena, how the sun rose and set, the moon cycles, the vegetation, the animal life. They were called forest dwellers. They coordinated the experiences of this external world, and they discovered that there was a supreme intelligence behind this show. There was a designer. There was a creator, a maintainer, with also a destructive capacity. Who was this creator? Why did he create? What purpose? It was not accidental. And so this literature of the Vedas, first from an oral tradition, shows the rationale of these seers, what we call the rishis of India. What is the reality behind this creation, preservation, and destruction? Being observers of nature, they depended on nature's benign capacity. The most ancient form of God is called a vara, tree, because tree provided shade. It cooled the temperature around this very hot, humid land. The Himalayas also were a form of God because their glacial waters helped them survive and also provided the water for the plains men and women farmers. Mother Ganges also provided water for their crops, for bathing and for drinking. So these forms of nature became objects of worship and veneration. And from then, gods and goddesses, the form of God, arose. And these first forms of gods and goddesses were connected to nature, fertility, harvest. But each god and goddess was supreme in his or her own right as a manifestation of the ineffable. So the ancient rishis realized the highest reality after hard struggle. In the early morning, they would leave their homes and go deep into the forest and practice their spiritual disciplines undisturbed. And they would return in the evening with visions of God. They experienced the ineffable, how it manifests in stones, in rivers, in trees. And they realized the ineffable, Brahman, how it especially manifests in the human heart. So these rishis sought answers to the mystery of life, and their questions and answers have been preserved and handed down through stories and teachings within what we call the body of literature known as the Upanishads, which is a Sanskrit word. It means secret teaching or sitting near devotedly. So we immediately understand what was religion to these ancient Hindus was something that was transmitted from teacher to student, orally and then written. Now these ancient rishis, they dealt with four fields of experience. What is the nature of the world? Their question is, what is that by knowing which everything can be known? This is in the Mundaka Upanishad. Who am I? This is in the Kena Upanishad, which literally means by whom Upanishad. In the Upanishad, it reads, at whose behest does the mind think? Who bids the body live? Who makes the tongue speak? Who is that effulgent being that directs the eye to form and color and the ear to sound? Third, what is the nature of the human mind? And fourth, what is the ultimate reality? Their realizations of God transcendent and immanent came down in the form of Mahavakyas, Vedic dictums, or mantras, revealed truths. The first, Tattvamasi, that thou art, meaning thou art the self, the supreme self, which is one with Brahman, God the Absolute. I am Atma Brahma. This self, this immortal self within, is Brahman. Pragyanam Brahma, pure consciousness, is Brahman. And last, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. Now the great seer philosopher, Shankara, in the late 7th century, collated all of these Vedic truths into the great non-dual philosophy, Advaita Vedanta, monistic philosophy. He said, Brahman, the absolute existence, knowledge, and bliss, is real. This universe is not real. Brahman, God transcendent, and Atman, God immanent, are one. What we call Sat Chid Ananda. Absolute existence, Sat, through which everything exists, the ground of our being. What was God to Moses when he said, I am that I am? Absolute consciousness, chit. Another Sanskrit word. These are Sanskrit words, chit. That which contains all knowledge in which we live, move, and have our being. And I'm going to explain this a little later. And then ananda, which means absolute bliss, what may be comparable in the Christian tradition to that peace that passeth all understanding. Now, what does this mean? It means that this world that we take to be a flesh and bones reality, a material world, is unreal. But beneath this world is this ground of being called Brahman. But we are unaware of it. We see only a solid world. But quantum physics sees something else. And really, the physicists today and the Vedantists they're our best friends, because the truths are coming very, very close together. For example, if we magnify the tip of a ballpoint pen 1,000,000 times, we see what ink molecules look like. And when we magnify this 1,000,000,000 times more, we can see the atoms of ink molecules. And when we select one atom and magnify it 10,000 times, we enter the nucleus. And here is the astonishing view of the smallest unit of matter. Robert Jastrow writes, the atom consists largely of empty space. Each of the atoms that make up the surface of the table consists of a number of electrons orbiting around a nucleus. The electrons form a diffuse shell around the nucleus, marking the outer boundary of the atom. The size of the atom is 10,000 times as great as the size of the nucleus at the center. So if the outer shell of the electrons in the atom were the size of the astrodome that covers the Houston baseball stadium, the nucleus would be a ping pong ball in the center of the stadium. This is the emptiness of the atom. So what began 10,000 BCE in ancient India, the worship of divinity in nature, ended in a sophisticated metaphysical science of non-dualism, what we call Advaita Vedanta, non-dual, not two, one, based on the revelation that parallels modern physics. Now, there is a great deal of misunderstanding about Hinduism, calling it pantheism, which it is not. It is monism. Pantheism is the worship of God within the forces of nature and the laws of the universe. Monism worships aspects of nature, gods and goddesses, as symbols of the absolute. Symbols of the absolute. According to Swami Vivekananda, one of the foremost exponents of Vedanta in this country, way back at the turn of the century, 1893, he said a personal God is the highest reading of the impersonal that can be reached by the human intellect. And what else is the universe but various readings of the absolute? So if we were to sit and try to comprehend the impersonal reality, a form would come to mind, or a qualified form. But within Vedanta tradition, there are many, many, many meditations on the impersonal aspect of God. There are also many meditations on the personal, and there are also many meditations on the qualified, non-dualistic approach to God. The non-dual meditations are given by a teacher, privately, without charge, to a qualified student. But basically, let me say that there are two separate paths of non-dual meditations, but they both end at the same place. There's the objective meditation on Brahman as the ocean of existence, pure consciousness. Then there's also the subjective meditations on the self, the subject, I am. So there are three approaches to both of these paths, and our focus today is on the subjective. Who am I? So to give you sort of a taste of some of these ancient meditations that have come down, for example, this body is as an empty urn, immersed in a blissful, luminous ocean of consciousness. Another type of meditation is this self is like a flame that tapers to a point and disappears into infinity. It is the light of all light which illumines all. Or a meditation on the sound symbol Om, which is the aggregate of all sounds. Now there is another form of meditation, but it's actually a non-concentrative meditation called self-inquiry. And it takes a very, very clear intellect, a lot of self-discipline to dismantle and deconstruct the false notions of the self, this apparent self that we have. And along with that, the objective world. Because how we see things depends on how we view ourselves. And I will explain this later. The self-objectified is the body and the mind, and even our possessions. If someone says, oh, what a pretty dress you have on today, I say, oh, thank you. I'm identified with what I am wearing, which is simply a garment. So also we become identified with terms such as I am a Democrat, I am a Republican. And what is so absurd is I carry life insurance. How can this I carry life insurance? This I and mine, these words, these labels have labeled something that is vast. It has put ourself into a box. So the Vedantists would say, seek the source of your own consciousness and refuse all answers that come to mind. Who am I? I am not this body. I am not this mind. I am the self, one with Brahman. And the aspirant is left, ultimately, with a natural insight awareness. But this comes through hard work. There is also a meditation on the sense of I am. I exist. That I amness which is at the core of my being, free from superimpositions, age, gender, personal history, appearance. I hope I'm not scaring you. What are the results? When our perception is transformed, this perception of the world is also transformed. when we discover, through insight, through vision, that which is Brahman, existence, knowledge, and bliss, it comes from a higher sense of self. And we will go deeper into this concept. It's a very, very, very deep and profound concept. The knowledge of who I am determines how I see the world, how I see this mind, how I see this ultimate reality. So this quest for self-knowledge is the most characteristic element of India's ancient spiritual tradition, the Vedanta. Buddhism differs from the Vedanta in that this sense of self is an illusion. In Vedanta we say, this self is the only thing that we can be sure of. There is nothing but the self. The capital S, this capital self, the higher self. So let us begin to analyze, who am I? In the Upanishads, there's a beautiful example of two selves are like real and apparent self. We have a real self with deep within us, and an apparent self, which is this psychophysical being. It's a type of multiple personality disorder. And the illustration is given of like two birds of golden plumage. This is from the Mundaka Upanishad, one of the major Upanishads. Like two birds of golden plumage, inseparable companions, the individual self and the real self are perched on branches of the self-same tree. The former tastes of the sweet and bitter fruits of the tree, the latter, tasting of neither, calmly observes the witness. The individual self, deluded by forgetfulness of his identity with the real self, bewildered by his ego, grieves and is sad. But when he recognizes the absolute consciousness as his own true self and beholds his glory, he grieves no more. So basically, we're pack animals. On our back is the unreal self. And basically what we're carrying within us is the true self. Now we enter into the process of what we call self-analysis. In Sanskrit it is called vichara. Who am I? The rishis dismantled this apparent self, this self-objectified finite self. Let's start. Am I the body? Well, first of all, let's start with a definition of what is eternal. Anybody got a good definition of what is eternal?
It never ceases to exist.
Okay.
Never ceases to time.
That which is eternal exists in the past, the present, and the future. So am I the body? What happens when I lose a limb or have a facelift? The body changes. This body at this age was not the same as it was when it was a newborn. So this body has changed over 62 years. Childhood, youth, adulthood. So this body is impermanent. This body is born and it dies. I am not the body. And yet day in and day out, we stand before the mirror, we groom ourselves, and think, ah, I look pretty good today. Or I don't look so good today. Or I'm feeling happy. I. Am I the mind? Any answers out there? Am I the mind?
You have a mind.
How do you define the mind?
First of all, the mind is changeful. There's a beautiful illustration that's given in an Eastern tradition. The mind is like a monkey. You try to quiet it, and it goes to the very thing you don't want it to go to. Not only is it like a monkey, but it's like a drunken monkey. And it's not just a drunken monkey, it's a drunken monkey stung by a bee. That is how unruly the mind is. So the mind is changeful. And if we watch the mind, we see that thoughts rise and fall. We see that my child's mind was different from my adult mind. And that as soon as I leave this room and go outside, the mind is going to change from that which is focused on this subject to something else. So this is very disconcerting. We're not the mind, according to the Vedanta Rishis. What is the mind? What are these thoughts? In the West, Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. I think, therefore I exist. The mind is considered autonomous, a process of thought, and consciousness, to many scientists, is considered an epiphenomenon of the brain. But to the seers of India, with a clarified and refined mind, they use the mind as an instrument to observe and probe the nature of the mind. In the Kena Upanishad, at whose behest does the mind think? Who bids the body live? Who makes the tongue speak? Who is that effulgent being that directs the eye to form and color and the ear to sound? They developed the art of watching the mind. They discovered that the mind is not autonomous. It is not a process. The mind is an instrument. It reflects consciousness. And so to the Vedantist, first, I am, therefore I think. So there is a deeper self. There is a deeper mind behind this mind that is a subtle spiritual mind existing in seed form. And this is where the point is between the individual self that blends with the universal self. Now the Rishis also examined the three states of consciousness, waking, dream, and dreamless sleep. And this goes on today in our practice. We may be particularly enamored of one aspect of this process of vichara, but it is not a dead science. It is a living science, a metaphysical science that is in use today. And through this examination of the three states of consciousness, they developed a power of insight and discovered that awareness continues at all times. Even in deep sleep, I am aware of what? I am aware of nothing. This nothing is an object of awareness. And this was brought, exemplified to one of our devotees when she lost consciousness in her bathroom. She fell unconscious, and she said, Brahma Prana, I was aware of nothing. Is this what it's going to be like at death? A sense of blackness. Let me give you a beautiful illustration of this consciousness by the experience of a great saint in India who passed away in the 1960s, Ramana Maharshi. Some of you may have heard his name. He's a great Vedantin, and he watched the process of his own death. He was sitting in his uncle's home on the first floor, and this was in South India, and he was 17 years old, only 17, and suddenly this fear of death gripped him. And he felt he was dying. Why? He didn't know. And he thought to himself, and this all happened just within a split second. What is dying? He asked himself. This body dies. And he lay down outstretched and became stiff as though rigor mortis had set in. He held his breath, his lips closed, and the body became corpse-like. This body is dead and will be taken to the burning ground, and it will be burnt and reduced to ashes. This young boy understood. This was not a process of reasoning, but a realization in a matter of seconds. But am I dead? He thought. Is the body I? This body is silent and inert. I feel my personality and the voice of the I within me. They're separate. So I am the spirit transcending the body. And this realization came in a flash that this I is something very real, and it is the only real thing, and fear of death vanished. His ego was lost in a flood of self-awareness, and this awareness that even in death, this awareness would remain. Today, many people from all over the world visit the Ramana Maharshi Ashram in Arunachala. I also visited there. It's an incredible experience. Westerners, Easterners, those people who are interested in non-dualism. So this search for the self is related specifically to the nature of consciousness. It is a reality in itself. It illumines thought processes. We are aware of everything through our consciousness. It is the first fact of perception that I am. The first thought when we awake in the morning is I am. And then we see the world around us. In fact, I see you within my consciousness. You see me within your consciousness. Not outside of your consciousness. It's all taking place within our consciousness. So we cannot understand the nature of this world until we first understand the nature of consciousness that reveals the world. If I don't know who I am, what do I know? Because this self-perception colors everything I know and see. We all see a different world. Some see a world of sorrow, and some see a world of light. But my perception of the ultimate reality is a function of my self-perception. And when that self-perception changes, the perception of God also changes. Let's take this podium. If I were a termite, how would I see this podium? As food. You and I are both identified as embodied beings. We are identified with our body and our minds. So we see this podium as a material solid object. But a physicist with an electron microscope sees it as empty space. And Arthur Eddington, in his book, The Nature of the Physical World, described, in the world of physics, we watch a shadowgraph performance of familiar life. The shadow of my elbow rests on the shadow table as the shadow ink flows over the shadow paper. The frank realization that physical science is concerned with a world of shadows is one of the most significant of recent advances. The great seer philosopher Shankara called this a framework of illusion, which rests on the ocean of pure consciousness, Brahman. This framework of illusion is called Maya, a Sanskrit word which means that which measures the immeasurable. So we have examples of great seers of illumination who transformed how they saw themselves and thus how they saw the world. I belong to the Ramakrishna Order of India. Ramakrishna was a great saint who lived from 1836 to 1886 in Kolkata. And he reached and attained heights of God consciousness. such heights that he never referred to himself as I, but as this body. Never as mine, but as this pillowcase, this place, he would say. This has eaten. Al-Halaj, the Iranian Sufi master, who was put to death. Before he was put to death, he was identified with his true self, not the body, and he said the great dictum, Al-Halak, I am the truth. Meister Eckhart, after his non-dual experience of Christ, said, the eye through which I see God is the same eye through which God sees me. My eye and God's eye are one eye, one seeing, one knowing, one love. First, the experience of what we call Brahman, Christ, Buddha, the state of awakening, and then we see through those eyes. So the nature of self-perception is based on two self-evident principles. First, I exist. I am. And second, I am aware that I am. And the self-awareness illumines its own presence and also this world around me. And the self-awareness is present in everything I experience. I take my self-awareness wherever I see, touch, feel. So this consciousness is the foundation of existence. Even Descartes understood that we can't be sure of this external world because it's based on five senses that are faulty. We can't be sure of our mental world because mental illness can distort that. But Vedanta says, my being is self-evident. I am. And that thinking follows the fact of my self-evident being. I am, and I am aware that I am. I am, therefore, I think. I cannot doubt my own self-existence, and none of you can doubt your self-existence. So these two self-evident principles are quintessential. My amness is the ground of my being. In the Mundaka Upanishad, what is that by which knowing which everything becomes known? And the rishis discovered that one principle, the source of everything, like a world of clay, like a wax museum, made of consciousness. Everything made of clay, everything made of consciousness. Ramakrishna saw this world as a wax museum, everything made of wax, as the ultimate reality itself. So all this time we have been seeing nothing but Brahman, but we are unaware of it because our concept of self is not up to speed. So this light which illumines all experience is a light that is not of this world. It's beyond time, space, and causation. And the first spiritual experience that comes to one who is practicing, it comes in the heart center. Ramakrishna describes that. When the mind ascends to the fourth plane, that's the fourth plane of consciousness, is the heart. The center designated in yoga as anahata, it sees the individual soul as a flame. Besides, it sees light. At this, the aspirant cries out, ah, what is this? What is this? Then everything is seen as a manifestation of that light of pure consciousness. So in conclusion, to know who am I, is it really that important? I have lived so long without knowing. But once we know, even intellectually, then we begin to practice intuitively, and a conviction grows within ourselves, and our whole world changes. We understand that it is the most important question we could possibly ask. Because the answer is the core of our existence, at the core of our nature, it is the meaning of our life itself. Ramana Maharshi asked, "Who am I?" That is the beginning and the end of Vedanta. So when we begin to pay more attention, not to what we are, but that we are, everything begins to shift inside of ourselves. We are able to deconstruct this false self, this self that is separate from the body, mind, and senses, this self that is separate from my personal history. There's a beautiful illustration in the Katha Upanishad. Know that the self is the rider and the body is the chariot, that the intellect is the charioteer and the mind are the reins. And so we stand on something more enduring, unshakable. And this I am is formless. Though I inhabit a form, this I am is formless. And when we began to probe this through meditation and discernment, what we call vichara, we began to feel a sense of timelessness about this sense of I am. And we began to feel that time is something that's added on top of I am. We feel that I am endures behind and prior to time itself, that there is something eternal about the self, that it is not subject to the waves of the experience of this world. And we began to feel something tranquil, joyful, and sacred. We feel the sacredness of existence itself. Thank you.
Yes. Okay, we'll open the floor to questions and answers.
Push the button on Bob until it turns green. Is it on?
So are you familiar at all with the older religious traditions of hunter-gatherers, totemic religions such as the Aborigine songlines, who are, their documents have been carbon dated at 50,000 years old? And rather than going in to transcend the environmental catastrophe that is agrarian culture, their religion seeks to go out to become part of the world and to lose oneself in the world. As Ortega de Gasset says, become the aware man. And of course, here in the United States, industrialism produced our transcendent movement to ignore the environmental damage done by industrialization. When you refer to the self, are you referring to the 90% of the cells that you carry around that aren't human?
We're referring to that which is beyond time, space, and causation.
Our bacteria cultures are most of what we carry around with us, and they long outlive us. But anyway, thank you very much. Very good production.
Okay, everybody please remember to formulate a question. Who wants to go next? Dr. Alkin?
I
don't
I am. I am a lot of things. I am my body parts. I am my mind. I am, but not any of those one things alone. The heart, my mind, my body can't live without everything. My heart can't live by itself.
That's a biological self.
My brain,
yes. Psychophysical being. Okay.
So, but then they all change, just like you say. They change from minute to minute.
Yes.
Okay, I am a man, mm-hmm. a father, mm-hmm. a doctor, mm-hmm. an American, mm-hmm. a Republican. Mm-hmm. I am all those things. Yes. And I step from one identity to another, sort of like avatars of Brahman, you know. But and yet, I am all those things. And I don't think you can, say I am just one. And also, I am My genes say I am. There's a question coming.
Okay. I'm just trying to discern what you're saying, but I don't think I can be any just one. Another of, the, of your cycle's physical.
I have many aspects of your cycle. And these things are given to me by my genes, by my environment, by my society, by my education. I am different from when I from my relationships. I am different from when I came into the room because of my relationship with you. Now, what happens? There's the question. What happens to that self if you take away the body? If you take away the brain? Are you saying that there's a self that exists beyond the body and the brain?
Yes.
And then what is it? Where does it go?
That's for you to realize. this cannot be a, this is a experiential and experimental. And there's, this is the only thing you have to believe in Vedanta, is to believe in yourself. And there are many paths, and we accept the various paths. I believe you were talking about the Aborigines. Yes, it's a very valid path, because there are many paths to God. There are many paths to a transcendental consciousness. But we're talking about a consciousness that is above this physical plane. There are not just three states of consciousness. In Vedanta, there are four. There is that superconscious consciousness. Yes.
Now my question is, it's personal to you, if it's okay to ask a question about this. Could you take us through your path and what you were like before you began the path and where you are now with the path, and how is that different?
Oh my goodness, we're talking about 40 years.
Just right now.
How am I different than when I first joined the convent?
Yeah.
Very different. I have a very, very different understanding. There's... One thing about embarking on a spiritual path, when you began to meditate and when you began to go beneath the intellectual level to an experimental and experiential place, when you began to do the work, you began to change inside. There's a great shift in consciousness. And sometimes it comes in baby steps, and sometimes it comes cataclysmically. It depends on the person. But it's like being on the train. Whether you're sleeping, whether you're standing or moving, the train is moving. When you begin a spiritual path, whether it's Catholicism, whether it's the Aborigine approach, whatever it is, you begin to change inside. And you begin to see things differently. You begin to develop tools you never thought you had. You began to have inner resources that you can draw on that you never knew existed before. So you become a happier, more peaceful person. And this is across the board. This is, you become much more intuitive. You become much more sensitive to the people around you, to their minds. You feel more intensely, and your capacity increases as a person, as a human being.
Question. I watched my father battle Alzheimer's, and he mentioned consciousness and the woman who had passed out, and I would look at my dad and think, there's got to be something still there. Would you comment?
That's yes. When you're going through some kind of an illness like that, it's very difficult to discern. I remember one very interesting experience I had was going to Seattle. That was where I was born, and going back to my my hometown and to visit the center there, the Vedanta Center. And there was a wonderful holy man there. He had come to visit us in Santa Barbara when I was a very young nun. And he used to tell us, it's very important to memorize scriptures, because you never know what's going to happen to your mind. And those treasures that you hold most dearly, memorize them. Commit them to memory. Well, he had a stroke, and he was actually the last couple years of his life, he was on a feeding tube, and he was unconscious, semi-conscious. And yet, when I walked into his room, it felt like a shrine room. This man had developed his life as a young monk, and there was a presence there. I almost felt like I was being watched, not by him on his bed, but by something much bigger than this body. It was a very unique experience. Now, with someone who has not tried to consciously develop their mind, the mind is matter. It disintegrates. That is not who we are. In our tradition, if you believe in reincarnation, that is what reincarnates this mind with its impressions. All of the personal history, this is what reincarnates. The body doesn't reincarnate. The mind does. That's what we call the subtle body. So what happened to your father was a karmic process, and you watched the mind disintegrating. But the mind in its seed form, in the Indian belief, is that is what reincarnates, not in its destroyed state, but in its seed form.
Question?
First, I'd like to thank you for coming out to the Dallas Philosophy Forum.
Thank you.
It's a great place for people to come and share their minds. And it's, you would hope that we'd get a bigger turnout. Sometimes it just doesn't happen that way. You touched on, there was three things that you touched on that I thought was interesting. The first one was, if I don't know who I am, then what do I know?
Yes,
I think that's, if I'm going to carry something out of here with me, I thought that was good.
Yeah, that is a good one.
Another one was, not what I am, but that I am.
That I am.
That was, now these are things that I'm going to, probably take with me and try to think about them later. The next one I would say is, and it's kind of interesting because the professor and I had talked about it while we were having dinner before you started your presentation. And that is, and he's going to send me a paper that he wrote. It's called The Ultimate Reality.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that just so happened that you said, just so happened, is that reality is change. Or is it the change of reality?
What was that? I'm sorry.
That you spoke of, in one of your sentences, you said that reality is change, or was it that change is reality?
I'm not sure that I said that.
Yeah, that's my question.
I'm not sure that I said that.
Definitely you said that, that reality is change, that the reality is that you're not the same as you were when you were.
But that is how we discern what is real. What is real is that which exists in the past, the present, and the future, that which is unchanging. So the body changes, therefore it is not real. That was the analogy. Using the definition of eternal over and against that, the psychophysical being.
Okay, so would you agree that maybe reality is
changed? I would say that... No, the opposite. I would say that reality is the self, and that is the only thing that exists, okay, within and without.
No, let's get other people a chance. Okay. Anybody else want
to? All right. Don't let him. I did transcendental meditation, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, for about 30 years. And whenever I would meditate, after I had learned how to do it well, I reached a state where I was aware, but not thinking. In other words, I found nothingness. I did not find a self. I did not find a thing. There was no consciousness, there was nothingness. And so my question to you is, where is this self that you talk about, particularly a universal self out there? Where is that universal self?
Well, there's no high or low or back or front to the self. The self is that which exists in the past, the present, the future. It's beyond time, space, and causation. What is quintessential in this practice of meditation? It's sort of like you go to college and you take courses from people who are skilled and what they're teaching. So it's like when you want to learn chemistry, you learn chemistry from a chemist. Otherwise, you can blow yourself up. So also, when you really begin to go deeply into spiritual life, you need a qualified teacher there. So because there are many pitfalls, there are many stumbling blocks along the way, and unless we have a qualified teacher to see how it is we are meditating, what is getting in the way, we have a tendency to actually be anchored in one place. So that is one of the things that we strongly urge. If you take up a practice, have a qualified teacher that you can go to with your questions, that can lead you along your path, because there are going to be things coming up along the way. There are pitfalls.
Well, and I had teachers, of course.
Uh-huh. But you need someone you can go to who knows you inside and out, who is qualified to teach.
Yeah.
And to help you. To help, because it is just, if not more important than going into a chemistry lab with a chemist.
Other questions?
So if you go to a qualified teacher and you hear and listen and observe, and then all of a sudden decide you don't believe what the qualified teacher tells you, then what do you do?
You don't go back to the qualified teacher.
The qualified teacher has the only answer, then where do you go from there?
Okay, first of all, let's talk about what are the qualities of a qualified teacher. There are qualities of a qualified student. And what do you think that those qualities are? Number one is truthfulness, a sense of wanting the truth. And embarking on a path of truthfulness, because we cannot realize the truth unless we practice truthfulness. Second of all, there are certain observances and austerities. With chemistry, you don't have to practice austerities. You can go into the lab. But in spiritual life, you have to do certain things that help to refine the mind. The control of the speech. Control, non-stealing. Compassion. Getting over your resentments by hook or by crook. You know, if God is everywhere and I resent somebody, that's going to stand in the way. Strong likes and dislikes. Trying to overcome. So we have to become qualified before we're even accepted by a teacher. Now, what are the qualities of a qualified teacher? Well, number one, seriously doubt anyone that says, I am a Paramahamsa. Anyone who makes claims has not had. That's sort of like the golden rule. That's the gold standard. Because this is not an advertisement. This is not a show. This is something that is a hidden treasure. If we're seeking to go beyond the ego, we do not want to hook up with somebody who has a huge spiritual ego. And also, as we develop our sensitivity and insight, we discern how we feel around a teacher who is illumined or qualified. We feel pure in their presence. We feel uplifted in their presence. So these are some of the signs, and what they say rings a bell in our heart. So those are some of the qualities. There are a lot of pop gurus out there. Believe me, I know. I was in Los Angeles during the 60s. And there were so many of them out there. But when you find the right one, when you find the real The real McCoy, you know.
You said you're from Seattle?
That was where I grew up. Yeah.
So, I think I noticed on your card you got your name is it, obviously that's not your birth name.
No, it's a Sanskrit name that's given at the time of final vows, sannyasa.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, I'm just curious if hopefully not being too personal about it, but you know sometimes your birth name is something that was given by your parents, and that probably some parents may want you to respect the fact that that's going to be your name for the rest of your life.
Some parents might.
Is that something that maybe your parents agreed to you changing your name?
My father passed away before I ever came into Vedanta, and my mother embraced Vedanta after I took my final vows. So my family is very open. I'm very fortunate.
Any other questions? Okay, let's go.